This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And so House Democrats moving forward with impeaching the president a second time, as we talked about yesterday, anticipated would happen yesterday, and it did happen yesterday. They're scheduling a vote for tomorrow, Wednesday, to impeach the president. Why would Nancy Pelosi want to do this with 8 days to go in his term as president of the United States?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. That's a question I put yesterday on my syndicated show to Dan Henninger from the Wall Street Journal. I think he had an excellent point that deserves some consideration in our conversation.
One question that I think you have to ask yourself is, why is Pelosi doing this? The country is at a white heat of emotion, no question about it. It's difficult to talk to people about this subject in any sort of rational way. We have this political bonfire burning, and she clearly is simply pouring more gasoline onto the bonfire. And I have begun to think that Pelosi believes that there's no downside for Democrats. I mean, in Nancy Pelosi's world, which is electoral politics, you're trying to win or lose elections, and you win or lose elections by getting more than 50% of the vote, or in the presidential elections, getting more electoral votes than the other guy. And I think what the game here is to keep the Trump issue aflame, keep him in front of the American people as a contentious issue. It unites Democrats and now divides Republicans.
We want you to go, but don't go.
Right.
We want you to go, but be a presence. And that key point that Henninger made at the end, where it unites Democrats and it divides Republicans. So we want to continue to use you as a cudgel to beat your supporters, beat Republicans with, to divide up Republicans, the Trump supporters versus the surrender Republicans, the establishmentarians that wanted to see Trump more or less go from the outset. I think that's the basis of this. Go, yeah, don't go.
Go, don't
go. We need you. We need you as a weapon for political purposes. And so there is no restraint on the demagoguery that we'll undertake in order to score those political points, to the point where, you know, what you're talking about is a Senate trial. Much to the chagrin, I'm sure, of Alan Dershowitz's interpretation of the Constitution, that you can't have a trial of a president that's no longer in office for impeachment purposes. They're talking about postponing a Senate trial until after the first 100 days of the Biden administration, right, so as to not interfere with his immediate legislative agenda.
And they said that, you know, and Biden came out yesterday and said, you know, we can do both, impeach Trump and, you know, focus on our new agenda. But if you're promoting unity and you want to start off fresh, then don't even touch the subject. And by the way, the Senate doesn't even get back until January 19th. So they'd have to be called back to Washington in rapid speed to get this done.
Well, they're not going to get it. No. They're not going to get it done. One is, there's a suggestion that maybe they could prompt a call for an emergency session before January 20th. But otherwise, right, they're not scheduled to be back in session until an hour after Joe Biden is inaugurated. So if there is no emergency session, there is no trial before Joe Biden is inaugurated. And now they're talking about, well, if he's already going to be inaugurated, let's just push it off so it doesn't interfere with the first 100 days. And Joe Biden's saying, well, that's all right, let's run it concurrent.
Yeah. And then
you're still talking about a trial after Joe Biden is president. The first act would be an impeachment trial against President Trump.
And I love how they put the onus on Mike Pence and say, you have 24 hours to decide whether or not you're going to invoke the 25th Amendment. And Pence finally met with President Trump yesterday in the Oval Office. They, you know, reporters said they had a wonderful conversation. He's not going to ask any cabinet members to, invoke the 25th Amendment on President Trump. So that's dead in the water. So now that's all they have is this.
There's something else about the articles of impeachment as per the authors of it, the article of impeachment against Trump, the incitement to violence, seditious incitement of violence. Here's what they said, these House Democrats, Cicilline from Rhode Island, Lou from California, Raskin from Maryland.
Adler.
Last Wednesday marked one of the darkest days in the history of our country. After months of agitation and propaganda against the results of the 2020 election, the United States Capitol was attacked as President Trump's supporters attempted to stage a coup and overturn the results of our free and fair presidential election. And we cannot allow this to stand, and so on and so forth. It was attacked as President Trump's supporters attempted to stage a coup and overturn the results of a free and fair presidential election. There's so much here with respect to speech. First of all, President Trump's supporters. At minimum, it was a mixed bag, as we'll get into, in terms of those people who breached the Capitol and engaged in violence. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, and that included some Trump supporters. There's no question about that. But this is a clear effort, speaking of divide and conquer, marginalize. As Bill McGurn writes in the Wall Street Journal, you know, at least Hillary Clinton said only half of Trump supporters were deplorables. Now what you have is all Trump supporters are tarred with the violence that was initiated by a small percentage of those supporters who were on site on January 6th.
But you don't even have to go to Washington, D.C. or stand even near the Capitol. Every Trump supporter is now it's a horrible, violent person.
Is a subversive, yeah. Is a seditionist. Every Trump supporter is a seditionist. That's the point, exactly. In addition to stage a coup and overturn the results of the free and fair. How is that going to happen exactly?
I don't know. Because one guy showed up with zip ties? I don't know.
Jonathan Turley, again, law professor from George Washington University, it wasn't a coup attempt. It wasn't an insurrection. It was a desecration. I'm going to sit in Nancy Pelosi's chair and leave a quart and an envelope at her desk. That's the way I'm going to overturn the presidential election results. I'm going to take a selfie at the lectern. That's the way I'm going to do it. I'm going to dress up with a Viking helmet and face paint. And this is what happened was terrible. And the violence is indefensible. And it's being completely overblown. The comparisons to 9/11 and Pearl Harbor. The idea that this was some failed coup attempt. And but by the way, in point of fact, it's interesting because they can't have it both ways. And so if I was a counsel for the president in the impeachment trial. So wait a second. This was a coup attempt. So that means it was planned in advance. So if it was planned in advance, and there's some evidence that there were at least some elements that talking about storming the Capitol weeks before the Save the America rally, if it was planned in advance, then how could Trump's words on that day have been the incitement for a plan that was already afoot?
Great point. That's true. I mean, one person brought 11 Molotov cocktails. The Antifa member.
Well, right, and we know.
If you go to a protest, yeah. You normally bring a sign. You don't bring a weapon.
And of course, we know, and there's video of this person. I don't think that person has been identified and taken into custody yet, but there's video of the person that left pipe bombs at both the offices of the RNC and the DNC, or at least it's believed to be the person who did that. But we know pipe bombs were left there because they were exploded by bomb techs. So, right. Yes, very interesting. Take a couple of your calls. Pat in Lockport.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a couple of comments, Dan and Amy, regarding Nancy Pelosi. Just real quickly, number one, she's a complete ass.
Oh, okay.
Secondly, she wants to perpetrate as much division as there is possible within the Republican Party. The only platform that they have is to hate and destroy Trump and his legacy, whatever is left of it. And thirdly, you have Biden, who says that he can do his first 100 days and do an impeachment at the same time. This is coming from somebody who can't find his shoes, let alone Velcro them shut. It's pathetic.
Thanks for the call, Pat.
If Biden really wants to start a new era in U.S. politics, why become embroiled in a lengthy impeachment? process? Well, I mean, just move on.
Well, yes, that's a fair question. Something else, too, since there was so much ridicule of those House and Senate Republicans who were going to and did lodge objections on January 6th during the electoral certification process. This was symbolic. This was a protest move. This has no chance of success. This is virtue signaling. Okay. What is this? What is this impeachment proceeding? If the standard is, does it have any basis in, does it have any chance of success, essentially, which is one of the arguments that was leveled against them, then what chance of success does this have, particularly after Trump has left office, which is how this is going to unfold, if it unfolds at all? What chance? You need 17 Republicans in the House, in the Senate, excuse me, in order to actually convict. What chance does that have? Because some senator said he committed an impeachable offense like Toomey. Well, that's still a separate and distinct thing from suggesting that this is worthwhile and that I want to participate in this. And I think the likelihood that some Republican senators will want to participate in this diminishes with each passing day that Trump is out of office.
Ben Sasse is the only one so far who's considering it, as well as, well, Toomey and Murkowski, too. But 17 GOP senators, that's a stretch.
Philip in Blue Island.
Protecting and defending the Constitution is why I think the impeachment and hopefully a trial and relieving Trump of Secret Service and all the perks of being a president, he needs to be stripped of all that. And these are people that were standing around, since we don't want to blame everybody that was at the Capitol. There was a lot of people just standing around allowing these people to basically go into the Capitol looking for, I mean, it would have been worse, yes, if they had found Pelosi or even Pence and strung him up the way they wanted to. So I'm blaming the people that were there that are supposed to be patriots to allow these people.
Oh, Philip, how could they? What, you wanted him to make a citizen arrest? I mean, yeah, there's more video coming out. Have you seen the new video? There's people walking. Everyone's got their cell phones out. They're walking around like, well, as if they're walking through a museum. But then you have certain people that were thugs.
You're not going to let somebody just, anybody just ruin your home or come into your house and write feces on the wall and all this crazy stuff that they were doing. It should have been if there were patriots out there, they should have been fighting against the
ones. There were some people yelling, Antifa's here, get out, don't go in. We have that audio too. They were saying, Antifa's infiltrated, get out, don't go in the building, don't go in the Capitol.
And so, Philip, I'm sorry. Hold on a second. You've thrown out a bunch of stuff, including standards I want to explore. So the standard is if you see somebody doing something violent, then you should intercede and stop their violence. I'm talking about civilians, not Capitol Police. That's what you said.
Correct.
So that standard applies to looting in Chicago. That standard applies to burning down a police precinct in
Correct.
Seattle. So those people, those Black Lives Matter protesters who fail to intercede with the violence there, they are culpable for the violence that occurred.
Correct.
They are.
I'm just saying. So,
all right.
But when you come to the to these people attacking the United States of America, the government, and you're just going to stand by and allow them to do this, and you say you're a part of them?
You got to
jump in and say, "Hey, this is my country."
Thanks for the call, Philip. I mean, I
understand that, but physically, if I'm watching a 200-pound man beat up on a cop, what could I do physically to intervene?
Well, I mean,
taken down.
Yes, you want people
realistic.
To try to appeal to civilized conduct and calmer heads. But I don't know if I'm at the Ellipse in D.C. and I hear about something happening at the Capitol, I'm supposed to. I mean, I think we're watching too many action movies here. I'm supposed to run into the Capitol and restore order, or I'm supposed to get, hey, you guys come with me. We're going inside the Capitol to restore order. Now I'm breaching the Capitol, too, but I'm doing it for good. And I mean, it gets complicated, which is, oh, by the way, why we have law enforcement.
And some law enforcement officers were taking selfies. And two of them have been suspended.
Yeah. So, okay. Why we have law enforcement and why we don't want to encourage vigilante justice. So, yes, we want to have people try to reason with others, particularly if they're fellow travelers, say, this is not what we do. This is not who we want to be. We are going to be respectful. We leave places better than we found them. That's what we do as Trump supporters. And some of those appeals, as you mentioned, were made. Obviously, they fell on some deaf ears. But just as I'm not going to hold people who participated in a protest over George Floyd's death responsible for people who committed acts of violence, I'm not going to hold Trump supporters who participated in that rally peacefully responsible for the violence either. You know, there's this thing called individual agency. You know, I'm my brother's keeper, but I'm not responsible for everything he does. Big difference.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about the House impeachment vote, impeachment 2.0, expected tomorrow, and the merits of that, as well as all things outgoing Trump administration related. Since you brought it up, Amy, let's also address the Capitol Hill, Capitol Police officer who was arrested and the two that were suspended for taking selfies. One put on a MAGA hat and so on and so forth.
Yeah, one let the barricade, or remove the barricade so they can go up the steps, and then they help themselves into the Capitol.
Well, that certainly speaks to the question of the performance of the Capitol Police, in addition to the reporting that suggests that Capitol Police did not accept help from federal agencies in advance of January 6th. The federal agency support that was offered to Capitol Police, but they were concerned about optics, and so they didn't take it. So it wasn't like the Trump administration was setting up the Capitol Police for failure. It wasn't it. But with respect to the officers on site interacting with the crowd, two things. One is that doesn't offload responsibility from those who rioted to the police. Because if the police were being accommodating, perhaps to a fault, then that was even more reason to avoid confrontations with police. That was even more reason to be respectful of police, as if you need a reason. That was more reason to be peaceful. That gives you less reason to react the way that, again, a few reacted and engage in acts of violence and trespass on criminally trespass on public property and so forth. Right.
Right.
So that's not a defense to anything that anybody who broke the law did, is that Capitol Hill police were accommodating, just to be clear. The second thing is, I don't know why we would be so surprised. And I don't know why that's a terminable offense if you're otherwise in doing your job. So what? So I took a picture with a Trump supporter. So I took a picture with an American citizen who said, hey, who is probably saying, back the blue, or thank you for what you guys do, as you often hear at Trump rallies and from Trump supporters if you've ever gone to a Trump event, which I have. So what's wrong with that? But this is the point. This is part of the purge now, too. This is reported like it's some capital offense by the Capitol Police, taking a picture with a Trump supporter. It's ridiculous. Now, if you fail to do your professional duty in this event, in the melee that occurred, and perhaps even provided opportunities that would have otherwise not been present in the for the melee to occur, that's a separate and distinct story. But this focus on, oh, they took selfies. So that means what? They were aiders and abettors of the violence? No, a selfie is not evidence of that. You have to go deeper.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but the police were completely outmanned, and they were there, and you know, and some of the people that were there were just, you know, part of the crowd, just talking to police, and then you had a bad bunch that became violent, and even one that hit Officer Sicknick in the head with a fire extinguisher and killed him. So it was, I mean, what else were they going to do? They were trapped. They couldn't go anywhere. I don't know. And then there's another point of contention that I have. This other U.S. Capitol police officer, Howard Lebensgood, he died of suicide the next day. He was off duty, but he came in to help and committed suicide the next day for some reason. I don't know why, but they're considering his death part of the death total from Wednesday's riots.
Even though he was announced as an off duty, I mean, the number five, not to get to spend too much time on this, but you had that officer Sicknick who was killed,
right.
Essentially murdered. There's a murder investigation.
And Ashley Babbitt.
And you had that Ashley Babbitt. And the other three medical emergencies, it's not clear that anything that occurred on the grounds was a proximate cause of the medical emergency that ultimately led to somebody's death from heart attack or whatever it was.
And who are these people? I have been looking for 3 days to try and find names or, you know, was it a male, female, older? Was it a heart attack? Because normally if you have a crowd that large, you are going to have someone that has a heart attack. I've covered riots and protests. Well, no, there's somebody also who has a medical emergency, diabetic seizure. I'm just saying it happens, and I want to know who these three people are. Have their families come forward to say, you know, he was or she was this. They were a Trump supporter. It behooves me. If you can help me out, find information, that'd be great, but I can't find anything.
You have obviously the effort underway to run Trump out of town on a rail.
Right.
But if you think that is where this stops, then you haven't been paying attention for the last 4 years, and you're certainly not paying attention now. Our very own Senator Sacka Durbin and our very own Representative Brad Schneider from the Enlightened North Shore of Chicago.
Working together.
Paul Sperry, who is a bureau chief for Investors Business Daily, realclearinvestigations.com as well, investigative journalist. Developing, Democrats in both the House and Senate are planning to draft legislation to classify MAGA rallies as, quote, domestic terrorist activity, unquote, and require the FBI, DOJ, and DHS to take steps to prevent such, quote, unquote, domestic terrorism. Durbin is leading the effort along with Representative Schneider, Paul Sperry reporting. So, a MAGA rally, meaning Trump supporters gathering together, is domestic terrorist activity, and this legislation would compel the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Homeland Security to prevent such gatherings. Is that a First Amendment freedom of assembly issue? Sure it is.
Yes, it is.
Does that give you a sense of what the attitude of the left is to you? It should. Is there anything obtuse about this? Anything unclear to anybody?
Well, and they also, the FAA is thinking about putting the Capitol rioters on no-fly lists. I mean, 90 people were arrested. But do you think they do that to Antifa or BLM members? What about the Antifa person who hit a Chicago police officer so hard in the left eye with a stone or, you know, that he lost his vision? Are they on a no-fly list? 52 Chicago police officers seriously injured protecting the Columbus statue. Any of those people? Where are they?
The editor of Forbes, Randall Lane, has urged companies not to hire communications officials from President Trump's administration.
Oh.
Lane said there should be repercussions for those who lied on behalf of Trump. Boy, I tell you what, repercussions for any political comms person who lied on behalf of a politician, if that's the new standard, the good news is that no comms person will ever work for a politician again. But again, the standards that are being imposed and whether or not there are any limiting principles to those standards, and how is there a limiting principle here? This is all private sector action.
Scary stuff.
Private. This is the manifestation of the purge in the private sector. You think, oh, well, that's just for, you know, Sean Spicer and Kayleigh McEnany. No, it isn't. What if you're a domestic terrorist who attended a MAGA rally? Should you be employed? No. Here's what's going on. Going back to Dan Henninger from the Wall Street Journal and my interview of him yesterday on my syndicated show.
But also as conservatives and Republicans, we have to be able to sort this out. Because as you're suggesting, make no mistake about it, the left is on the offensive. They are trying to use what happened last Wednesday as a pretext for pushing conservatives out of politics. They always have tried to do that. This is an extension of what began to happen on the campuses years ago. I'm sure on your program, you talked many times about campus speakers being driven off the stage. Well, this is the same thing. And now you've got tech companies like Twitter and Facebook and Amazon participating in it.
And here's what happens when you prevent people from participating in politics, or you prevent people from gainful employment. You push them to the margins of society, and you can push people into doing things they might otherwise not be inclined to do, bad things. So you really want to stand idly by and say, because Trump is not the most sophisticated communicator the world has ever seen, because Trump is petulant, because Trump has had bad moments, then we're going to stand down while the left runs roughshod over anybody and everybody who's ever had a positive word to say about President Trump, which is basically their disposition, as far as I can tell, in this moment. And you think that's going to work out well? While they're preaching unity, they're going to do that? While they're preaching healing and reconciliation? How do you think that ends? Well? Brian in Oak Forest.
Hey, good morning, guys. So I'm off Twitter. I'm off all other social media except for Parler, which obviously we can't communicate on right now unless it's up and running this morning, which I doubt. But my question is, do you guys have the ability of getting the arrest sheet from everything that happened at the Capitol on Wednesday? Because maybe that'd be a good direction of where these people are coming from. So that's all I got.
So far, we know of the 90 arrested, they come from 25 different states and one from D.C. But yeah, we're going to have to dig into their arrest records and see if they're Antifa, BLM, Trump supporters, crazies.
Yeah, we know a little bit more than that. We also have one of the individuals who was arrested outside the Capitol, according to his family, is not a Trump supporter, but a Black Lives Matter supporter. He is not a Trumpster. Andrew Hanselman said of his stepson, Logan Grimes, age 25, not a MAGA person. We're a very progressive liberal family. If there was any reason my son was even present, it's because his stand against what a lot of those folks who did horrible things yesterday. But he was arrested. Let's take a couple more calls here. Mike in Plano.
Hey, you mentioned that domestic terror bill that Durbin and Schneider want to put forward. Well, what about your good friend Andy McCarthy, who went on TV and said the people at Capitol Hill reminded him of domestic terrorists that he used to prosecute? This is a guy, how does he call himself a constitutional conservative, yet he constantly uses the talking points of the left wing and the neocons, who seem obsessed with wanting to label Trump supporters and anybody that offends their sensibilities as domestic terrorists? I'd like to know what this guy actually conserved outside taxes and big business judges.
Well, thanks for the call, Mike. If Andy McCarthy, I didn't catch his comment specifically, although I did talk about his view that what Trump said on January 6th was an impeachable offense. I disagree. But if he's talking about people who breached the Capitol and were behaving like barbarians, then I have little sympathy for those people. I suspect he was not talking about all of those Trump supporters who were present on January 6th and who were peaceful. I assume he was talking about those who decided to engage in lawless conduct. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Yes, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Like I said before, I listened to this speech several times, and to me there was nothing in there that I heard that would tell me that he was telling them to revolt against the government. So, I mean, I just don't understand what they're trying to do in this whole situation.
They're trying to do exactly what...
If you tell the average person, or if the average person listened to this, they would say, why are they trying to impeach him? But what they do is they go out and they throw out this big word, insurrection. And everybody said, oh, well, that must be bad because of what they're saying. But to me, it doesn't make any sense. He did not say anything at all in that speech to tell anybody to go out and attack the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And Amy, I agree with you 100%. When I watched those videos, it looked like a lot of those people were on tour, and everybody's going to be held up because of some morons that got out of hand. Thank you.
Thanks
and have
for the
a good
call, Rich. John in Bridgeport.
All right, Chicagoans, lend me your ears. Let's go back 4 years, and let's ask that scumbag congresswoman up north, Jan Schakowsky, if her husband was part of the rally last Wednesday. He seems to like to go to MAGA rallies. Correct me if I'm wrong, guys.
Okay, thanks for the call, John. Tom in Oswego.
Good morning, Danny and Amy. I'll tell you, this is a tough call to make this morning. The people that are going after Trump, not just Trump, but all of his supporters, anybody associated with, to me, they're evil. I learned firsthand. My son is a final semester in law school. And last night he took down his Facebook post. And, you know, we're in a lot of hurt here in this family because we're not necessarily supporting everything Trump does, but we do agree with a lot of what he does. So now it's starting, it's ripping, trickling down to my son, who is now almost fearful for that when he graduates and takes the bar, are they going to be coming after him? And this is sad. I really am angry at these people. And I know what happened at the Capitol was wrong. I agree. But I can understand the pent-up anger. And I'll tell you what, it is now seeping into the normal people, as I call it, like myself. We are getting angry out here. And when you start affecting what happens to my family, then you better back up. Because I'll tell you, this is getting bad. Thank you, guys.
It is bad. And I remember when the rioting was happening, one of my dear friends texted me, this is effed up, and you voted for him? I'm disgusted. So that's my fault. I'm not. So every Trump supporter's rioting at the Capitol now? We're all violent? That's what that message sends.
Well, and also it's intended to put you on defense as if Trump supporters, as a general rule, condone violence when, in point of fact, conservatives and Trump supporters do not and have not right. and have not in this moment, just
condemning
as they didn't
violence.
Last summer. And that distinguishes us from so many on the left who did precisely that, who spent most of last summer appeasing the creators of autonomous zones mm-hmm. and contextualizing the violence that beset urban and not so urban America for the summer into the fall, and all the while watching homicide rates in places like Chicago go up 55% as police were told to stand down. And then we're going to get moralized to about what a handful or few handfuls of knuckleheads did on January 6th, that they have the moral high ground when it comes to living in a peaceful, pluralist society. Please. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. St. Andrew of COVID-19 delivered the State of the State address for the state of New York yesterday. And
my, oh my.
Yeah, listen to this pivot.
Fourth, we must plan our economic resurgence. We simply cannot stay closed until the vaccine hits critical mass. The cost is too high. We will have nothing left to open. We must reopen the economy, but we must do it smartly and safely. Also, we must energize our lagging private sector and rebuild our economic platform, our transportation system, our infrastructure system. for the next generation of growth.
Sounds like a guy who's engaged in human experimentation with the virus running wild and vaccine distribution not going particularly well in New York State. How, based on his own position and his own rhetoric for the last 10 months, could Andrew Cuomo be so reckless when we're out of an abundance of caution, we're supposed to take evasive action and stay alone together in order to save lives? This piece of work, man, this piece of work, that is as close as you're going to get to an admission of guilt from St. Andrew of COVID, America's governor.
Well, that is it's sickening. But do you think it's going to happen here?
Somebody who is saying that is somebody who is saying two things. One, I can't hold the line anymore in terms of the political capital I'm expending. Two, I may not get exactly what I need, even with a Biden administration and a Democrat-controlled Senate. I may not get the dollars I was hoping to get from the feds in terms of a bailout. So out of an abundance of caution for my political future, which is all he really cares about, I'm going to pivot and pretend like, after much consideration, I'm making this difficult decision. No, pay no attention to my conduct or rhetoric, decision-making for the last 10 months.
There's nothing left to open if he continues this. I mean, their positivity rates have been about 2.9%. Now they're at 6.22%. But the big problem is they have a $15 billion budget deficit.
Yeah, right.
Because of all of this closures. Right. I mean, basically, New York is shut down.
This has nothing to do with where the virus is or isn't. Because regardless of where the virus was or wasn't in terms of its prevalence, in terms of the number of infections, hospitalizations, and deaths, Andrew Cuomo pursued the same lockdown and bust policies as other lockdown and bus governors coast to coast pursued over the last 10 months, did he not? And now this watershed moment at his State of the State address? Honestly. Oh, by the way, on vaccines, you know, America's governor, along with Mayor Warren Wilhelm, this is a remarkable thread. I tweeted it out yesterday. Scott Stringer is the New York City comptroller. This thread is made all the more remarkable by the source of the information. The New York City, the NYC Healthy site, which is New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, and apparently the clearinghouse for signing up to get vaccinated. The NYC Healthy site has a multi-step verification process just to set up an account, then a six-step process to set up an appointment. Along the way, there are as many as 51 questions or fields in addition to uploading images of your insurance card to sign up to schedule yourself to get vaccinated. And you wonder why nationally there have been 22 million doses distributed and only 6.7 million vaccinations, according to recent numbers. New York State's the model, right?
Do they understand old people don't like computers? A lot of older people don't have computers, and you tell them to upload something, they're not going to know what that is. You have to make it easy for people.
Well, this is exactly the New York City comptroller's point. So where is St. Andrew of COVID and Mayor Warren Wilhelm?
Well, what they're going to try to do is open mega sites, six mega sites where they can have 24-hour vaccinations 7 days a week.
Yeah, and what they're doing is wrong, because they've gone around the county plans that have been developed over years. They've tried to centralize this, command control it, and it's been a catastrophe, yet another catastrophe in New York State and New York City. Imagine these able managers. Oh, what, an Andrew Cuomo press conference won't solve this, big D.C. and New York City press corps? Wowing you with his rhetorical flourishes behind a table while he pillories any impudent questions from any actually intellectually curious member of the press. Oh, that doesn't get people vaccinated? Well, What a development, huh, press corps? Oh, meanwhile, what state's doing it the best? What state's doing vaccinations the best, do you think?
Utah. No, Florida, of course.
No, South Dakota.
Really?
South Dakotans had received vaccinations as a more South Dakotans had received vaccinations as a percentage of the population than in any other state, according to CDC tracking. You know why? Because Kristi Noem, a light touch governor, not a lockdown governor, had planned also cooperation among health systems that are natural competitors, as well as enlisting the private sector. This is the point our friend Dr. Joel Zinberg made in a piece in the City Journal. Rather than, you know, Paulette Bureau style management of vaccine distribution, you know, enlist the healthcare infrastructure, the private healthcare infrastructure that serves tens of millions of Americans every single day. What a concept. And let them offer their own solutions at the local level, subsidiary power or access at the point closest to the people. It's just remarkable. Remarkable to watch that 180 by Andrew Cuomo. Listen to it. It will be received completely uncritically by the D.C. press corps, the Eastern Seaboard Press. Nothing that happened up until this point will be given any reconsideration. There will be no uncomfortable questions asked. It will all be, oh, yes, this stewarding us out of this difficult time through the choppy waters. Andrew Cuomo went where the evidence led him to go. Well, what happened?
It's so stupid. It's like reopening is going to be, you know, is going to be relying on COVID testing to reopen restaurants, art centers, and theaters.
Meanwhile,
what, you got to give a saliva test before you can go in and see a show on Broadway?
Meanwhile, everything that he has managed has been catastrophic. And the leader in catastrophes in the nation, which is saying something, because there's a lot of catastrophic governors, including our very own Jelly Belly Pritzker.
Well,
Oh, by the way, there's a press conference today here. The Fulton Market Association, part of the Chicago Restaurants Coalition, doing another presser. Apparently, the presser that we talked about last month didn't go anywhere. Surprise, surprise.
Well, we should be in phase four. We should be having restaurants open right now, group classes and gyms and travel sports, because that's what the science and data proved.
Outdoor press conference today, 1 p.m. at Pompey Restaurant over there on Taylor. The speakers will ask Mayor Lightfoot and the 50 aldermen to challenge Pritzker's indoor dining ban, which has been effective for 75 days and has caused tremendous financial pain and uncertainty for Chicago's 7,300 restaurants and their 75,000 employees, say these restaurateurs. Here's a letter from Rick Bayless in support of the restaurateurs. Rick Bayless, celebrity chef. I'm not using my voice to save my restaurants. I'm using my voice for the independent restaurants. You probably know this, but restaurants, bakeries, bars, coffee shops employ more non-white managers and young people than any other industry. Immigrants, a million single mothers, and the formerly incarcerated rely on restaurants for their livelihoods. We can't leave these communities jobless. No one argues the fact that people are dying from coronavirus and tough measures must be taken. It's easy to simply say close all the restaurants and feel like we've eliminated the problem, but we haven't. We instead created a massive unemployment problem and rampant bankruptcies. Most of all, we forced restaurant operators to fight for their lives, mostly by scoffing at government regulations, then going underground to host clandestine indoor dining and gathering. In effect, the sledgehammer call to close all restaurants can be looked at as fueling the surge of coronavirus, not curbing it. Not to mention, there's no definitive evidence that indoor dining of small parties at 20% or 25% capacity is unsafe.
1.4%.
I say to not reopen restaurants at 20 or 25% capacity is irresponsible and wrong. These restaurants are ready to place safety at the front and center of everything they do. Indeed, it's time to forge forward, restore indoor dining at low capacity, and help restaurants survive. Rick Bayless, open letter to the mayor and the city council. Oh, and, you know, Alderman Hopkins.
Yeah.
And Alderman Hopkins chimed in with his own letter to the mayor, but who cares what these aldermen say?
It's not the mayor. It's Pritzker. He's got all the power. He has all the control. We're getting there, Dan.
Things are going in the right direction. January 15th, we'll be able to move regions from Tier 3 to whatever tier they're qualified for at that point.
The Tier 3, Tier 2, Tier 1, stop. Just go back to Phase 4, okay? The numbers are there. You know, they set the metrics, and we're below the metrics. We're at 7.9% positivity rate.
You sound like a member of the Pritzker administration.
I know.
Stop
I'll take
at
your tier
two, tier three. Go to phase four. Okay. For those
what about
of us,
phase one A not... for vaccinations, we can go there too.
Yeah. Okay. So for those of us not conversant in the commissar lingo,
here's the bottom line. You don't want to go to tier two. You don't want to go to tier. Tier two is nothing. There's no change between tier three and tier two. Except that you can gather with more people outside. So you just want to get to phase four, which we were before, before November 20th. Yes, Dan, go.
That was very helpful in terms of clarity, wasn't it?
Well, that's what's on their website. Their website's a hot mess. They keep saying, oh, go to the website. Well, that says tier one. If you look at tier three and tier two, they're exactly the same, except for the number of people that can gather outside. So why just go back to phase four? Which we should be at right now, but they're waiting because somebody had a New Year's Eve party, Dan. I don't know who that somebody is, and now we all have to pay for it.
Tier 4, Phase 2, Phase 3, this is what the website says. Here's a concept. Here's a simple concept. Yeah. Allow businesses to open and manage their own affairs and patrons to decide if they want to visit any of the businesses
right.
that are open.
Give people choices.
Phase
Brilliant
two
idea.
This, phase three that, phase four that. This is a meaningless mumbo jumbo. You either reopen the economy and make it simple, because things that are unknowable are tantamount to the suspension of the rule of law, if the law is unknowable. And it is unknowable. And no amount of media and politicians going back arguing about laminated sheets with phases and tiers makes it knowable. We're going to give people dominion over their own property back. We're going to trust people. We're going to light touch it the way that governors like DeSantis and Noem are doing successfully. That's the way we're going to do it. And then we're going to focus on our core responsibilities, like getting these vaccines into the hands of people who can actually administer them, as opposed to, as I said, running the vaccine distribution like we run the city of Chicago Public Schools.
Well, that's ridiculous. And I asked Pritzker that yesterday because this is very important. All of our friends that we know, their parents that live in Florida for 6 months and one day, they've all been vaccinated. Why don't we have that here? Why don't we have nice things?
So Amy Jacobson asked this question. A lot of our friends' parents have already been vaccinated in Florida. They live on their own, not in nursing homes, and waited in line in their cars. Why aren't we doing this here in Illinois?
Well, they're depriving seniors of vaccines when people who don't belong in the category that's been approved are allowed to get vaccines. I just read a story about foreign nationals who are flying to Florida to get vaccinated ahead of people who are authorized to be vaccinated. That's improper.
Foreign nationals flying to Florida and cutting in the line? No.
Yeah, I heard
them. Right, but they have to be here. And according to DeSantis, and I read it yesterday, they have to be here for 3 weeks at least to get the second shot.
And
it's not illegal.
Pritzker, Governor Pritzker, I read a story about in-person New York City teachers are being outraged over remote staff being offered the vaccine at the same time. Would you like to comment on that? In New York City, New York State. Would you like to comment on that, or do you only have fairy tales to tell about states run by Republican governors? Frank in Franklin Park.
Hey, you know, if you put a pipeline in or a drill, you got to do an EPA study and do all this other stuff to prove that you're not going to harm the environment or kill the spotted owl. Where are the studies, the scientific studies, double-blind studies, to show what, you know, tier one versus tier three, or that the spread is actually caused by virus? Where is all this science that they keep referring to? I have not seen any of it. Do you guys ever see any of it?
Thanks for the call.
On their website.
Nick in Des Moines.
Howdy. The best response to Andrew Cuomo waking up and understanding that he needed to open his businesses was on Twitter yesterday. Somebody said, you either die a lockdown hero or you live long enough to turn into Ron DeSantis.
That's awesome.
But to be fair to Governor Cuomo, he's not the worst Democratic big-time governor failing. I'm on the CDC website right now, and California is one of 9 states that's still below 2% of the population vaccinated. So Governor Newsom might be having a recall sooner than he thinks.
Yeah, that's right. I mentioned that yesterday. Thanks for the call, Nick. 1 million signatures so far. They got to 500,000 to go by March, and you got a recall election. Boy, if Newsom got recalled over his handling of the COVID matter and his hypocrisy, be part of that, of course, that would finally be a message that would perhaps reverberate through the halls of power occupied by Dem socialists. Right.
And it's also, too, his handling this vaccination. They've had to throw out batches that expired because they don't have enough people in their phase 1A plan who wanted to take the vaccine.
Tony in Downers Grove.
Well, you know, maybe Chicago can take a page out of the western suburbs and on the south side where, guess what? Restaurants are open. I was in Downers Grove. Well, I live in Downers Grove, but every restaurant was open. And they're just saying, hell with you, we're opening. So the governor could do what he wants, but the mayors are saying, you know what? We're just going to turn our head. You go do your thing. And people were in there and they're dining. So it's happening and it's going to continue to happen.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've gotten a number of first-person accounts of what happened on January 6th from listeners. But I want to get another one, particularly because Jenny White wrote this op-ed at thefederalist.com, which we discussed a bit, explaining why she was going to the Save America rally on January 6th in advance of actually attending, talking about the activism that has punctuated her life throughout her professional career while homeschooling, I think it was 5 children, if I'm remembering correctly, and how this, you know, effort to voice her concerns about what transpired on November 3rd was sort of her last best bit of activism in hopes that a concerted effort by ordinary Americans can actually make a difference in how our free society operates. For more on that, what she thought going in and what she thinks coming out and what she witnessed on January 6th, pleased to be joined by Jenny White. She has a master's in biology, former education director and co-founder of Reclaiming Oklahoma Parent Empowerment, contributor to The Federalist and American Thinker as well. Jenny, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
So we sort of characterize what you had intended by attending. You know, what was the motivation for you to attend on January 6th? Tell us what you saw and what you took away.
Well, honestly, it was really an exciting place to be. We drove 20 hours. I'm from Oklahoma, so we drove 20 hours in the car to go, and we were all excited. We got there early on Tuesday morning, and, you know, the city was kind of cordoned off. It was hard to get to our hotel room, and we were staying at the JW Marriott, which is at the corner of 14th in Pennsylvania. So we had we were in the 10th floor, so we had a great view of everything that was going on. But it was a little disconcerting even getting there because we had to almost get permission. We had to show that we were, you know, actually staying at this hotel in order to even be able to get beyond the areas that were blocked off.
Okay, and then so then you attend the events on Wednesday, and what transpired?
Right. Actually, it was great. We got there very early. We stood for over 5 hours to wait for President Trump to speak. We were standing, I mean, literally shoulder to shoulder. You just couldn't even move. I mean, it was like being a mummy almost. And every place you turned, you could see people. I was standing, our group was standing kind of right up at the front. And you could look back and see beyond the Washington Monument, and there were just people everywhere. If there were any nefarious ideas by anybody in that group, it would have been unbelievable. I mean, you just wouldn't have been able to move. There would have been stampedes, but that wasn't what happened. We sat there very quietly, listened to the president speak. He never said anything that incited violence, never. In fact, he said peaceful rally, you know, peaceful march several times. There was nothing. Nobody in that crowd was stirred up even a little bit.
So after the president spoke and then things started to break up, people going their own ways, what was that like? What happened?
Well, everybody was very orderly. They just kind of, you know, you kind of shuffled along for a little bit until you could finally actually walk. And a great group of them headed up Pennsylvania Avenue. We actually went back to our hotel room because we were freezing cold and there weren't any facilities to use. And we were hungry. So we went up to our hotel room. And it was there that we found out we were watching the report. We flipped on the television just to see what was going on at the Capitol, and we only had MSNBC and CNN. And so we looked at MSNBC and were absolutely shocked. I mean, and it was the weirdest thing that I've ever experienced in my life. We were sitting there watching the television, watching these pictures of people just wandering around in the Capitol, taking pictures in the rotunda, you know, going back and forth between these ropes. And then at the same time, the commentator was saying, there's been violence in the Capitol and there's the Capitol has been breached and screaming and yelling. And we ran to the window to look down thinking, oh my gosh, we're going to see something horrible. We saw nothing. I mean, we looked down, there were people in the streets looking like they'd just come from a picnic. I mean, there were people of every age, old people in wheelchairs, families with kids, dogs. I mean, it was just like a park. I mean, it was crazy. So what we were seeing on the television was not what we were seeing, you know, just right there at the corner of 14th and Pennsylvania.
Jenny, did you go to the Capitol then to see for yourself what was going on?
We actually did. After, you know, we warmed up a little bit, we went to the Capitol, walked up the street. It was crazy. We were kind of walking up as a lot of people were coming back, but everybody was orderly. There was nothing that even you could assume was violence. And we were even asking people on the street, hey, why are you coming back from the Capitol? And they were like, well, we need to go to the bathroom. Well, we're freezing cold. There were very few porta potties out there. There weren't any kind of trash receptacles. I mean, people just were tired and cold and were going back. So we kept walking and we got to the Capitol. And again, there were people in the street selling Trump gear. There were people singing and street performers. It was a very kind of carnival-like atmosphere. And we just were we had no idea. So we kept walking and walking and we got to the stone wall that surrounds the Capitol grounds. And we stood there and looked, and we could see people in the bleachers that they put up for the inauguration. And we could see people standing around, but we saw nothing that looked violent. They were just standing around, standing in the grass, sitting on the reflecting pool, standing around it was nothing that you could possibly, it just never matched. What we saw with our own eyes never matched what they reported in the media.
So when you reached the Capitol grounds, then what kind of police presence did you encounter? And was anybody talking about, because I'm assuming that you're there at the same time that people are inside the Capitol, defacing it and so forth, all that we have seen now through the reporting. So what was the police presence and what was the sense, you know, even just sort of in the outer ring of the Capitol as to what, if anything, was going on inside the Capitol?
You would have had no idea. There was no police presence. There were no people screaming and running. There was no violence. There was no turning over cars. There was nothing like what we saw during the mostly peaceful protests in the spring. Nothing like that at all. There was at one point where we did see the I guess it was the D.C. police, we couldn't see, somebody throwing flashbangs, and there was some pepper spray, and we did see some people, like they were trying to disperse people from around the Capitol, and we did see some people run by us that looked like they'd gotten pepper spray, but again, we saw absolutely no indication that there was anything violent going
right,
on
but
at
that
all.
Didn't mean it didn't happen. I mean, you guys just weren't inside the Capitol at any point
oh,
in time.
Oh, no. I don't want to say that either. I'm not saying nothing happened. I'm saying what we saw was not what other people who were inside the Capitol saw. What I'm trying to explain is it was not an incident that was encompassing everybody that was there. Right. This was clearly a very small group of people who did this. It wasn't the vast majority of people that were around.
So what did you, and then did they eventually put the whole town on lockdown and were you forced into your hotel room?
Yes, that was the other thing that was really frustrating because she did state a curfew from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And the thing that I don't think people understand is in D.C., all of the restaurants were closed. I mean, she had closed all the restaurants. There was no restaurant that was open even in our hotel. So we got back to our hotel about 4:30 or so because there just really wasn't anything to see or do. So we went back to the hotel and about 7:10 or so, we just noticed all these lines of police cars coming toward the hotel and we couldn't figure out what was going on. But there were about 16 vans of police officers in full riot gear that surrounded the hotel. And we were very curious to know what was going on. Eventually, one of the people in our group went down to the lobby and found out that basically the hotel was surrounded. They wouldn't let anybody go out, even to smoke a cigarette. And like I said, there were people inside. We drove because we had a feeling that might happen, and we brought our own food with us. But there, we were meeting people in the hotel who were like, well, I don't even have anything to eat. There wasn't anything to eat. You could only drink water out of the tap. It was like being in a police state. And we even called. We had friends in two different hotels in D.C., and we called them, and their hotels were also surrounded by police and riot gear, and they couldn't go out. You couldn't even go out to smoke a cigarette, or they threatened to arrest you.
So the she is Muriel Bowser, the mayor of Washington,
correct,
D.C.,
the
that
mayor.
You're referring to.
Yes.
And
yes,
with respect to just sort of what you saw, you didn't see any interactions, you didn't see any protesters, you didn't see any even arguing through your entire time there, both at the speech and then when you came back from your hotel to the Capitol. So it was only by watching television and reading news reports, despite the fact that you were at the outer perimeter of the Capitol, that you understood what had happened inside the Capitol.
That's very well said. I agree completely, yes.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, it's just interesting because, of course, if you watch it on TV, you see, I mean, there's definitely, and the reports, I think, suggest there's a few hundred people. But I think, you know, so that you get one perspective from an aerial view. And then if you're just a person on the ground there amid tens of thousands of other people, it's hard to know what's going on. And it's interesting that you're suggesting as you're mingling with other people, like word isn't making its way through the crowd that all that occurred at the Capitol was actually ongoing at the time.
Well, and that's an interesting point that you bring up that I hadn't even thought of until you said that. I think when we were walking toward the Capitol from our hotel room, we kind of expected people to go, oh my gosh, you wouldn't believe it, what's going on. And we heard none of that. It was just, I'm exhausted. I've been on my feet all day. I'm really cold. I need something to eat. It was nothing like that. So we were just absolutely, completely walking, going, what is going on? It was just so bizarre to try and reconcile what we saw on the television with what we were seeing in person.
And so then what you have seen now in terms of the reaction to what occurred and what you had hoped would be a takeaway going into January 6th versus what the takeaways are now. Just comment on that.
That's very disappointing, obviously. I mean, and it's particularly disappointing when you view it from the optics of there. We watched all summer and spring people turning over cars, people hitting each other, lighting fires, ruining businesses, and none of that amounted to a hill of beans in the media other than they were mostly peaceful protests. We could just understand that. This group was a completely peaceful, hundreds of thousands. It had to have been people. I mean, you couldn't have been that packed in that big of an area and look out and see nothing but a sea of heads, you know, for it to be that. And there was nothing like that happened. And yet suddenly now we're the problem. it is absolutely probably the most scary, frankly, beyond frustrating. It's beyond frustrating. It's just scary how you can demonize a set of people for some actions that were taken. And I've been looking at a lot of video because we did a lot of debriefing on it. You know, a 20-hour ride back home in the car, looking at videos, reading what people were saying. And what people are saying just doesn't, what we're seeing in videos and hearing from other people just doesn't match up to the media narrative. I mean, this isn't what people like us do. I mean, we went as the Tea Party, you know, we went to Washington, D.C., hundreds of thousands of us again, and we left the mall cleaner than it was when we got there. I mean, that was reported in several media outlets at the time. And now this group is being accused of being, you know, instigators of a riot. It doesn't make any sense. You have to look historically, and historically, that's not what this group of people who went to see President Trump speak on the 6th. That's not the way these people act. I do believe there were bad actors that kind of forced the hand of this. I'm not saying that everybody in, you know, that supports President Trump, you always have outliers, but I'm saying the vast majority of us are good people who just wanted to redress our government like our Constitution allows us to do.
Jenny White, she has a master's in biology. She's former education director and co-founder of Reclaiming Oklahoma Parent Empowerment, and a contributor to The Federalist and American Thinker. Jenny, thanks for joining us and sharing your perspectives. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan and Amy, for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jenny. And also, Dan, you know those three people that died from medical emergencies? One, Ben Phillips, 50 years old. He had a stroke, died in the hospital. Kevin Greeson, 55-year-old from Alabama. He was on the phone with his wife when he suddenly dropped dead from a heart attack on the sidewalk. And the third is Roseanne Boylan, 34 years old from Georgia, and there's no word on what happened to her. And by the way, Jenny White joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and spoke with Andy Ngo, a good journalist, Portland-based, also with Postmillennial now, and wanted to get his perspective because he's been doing some good reporting since January 6th, including on January 6th, noting something that not too many others in the press corps nationally have noted, that while the indefensible rioting that occurred on the inside the Capitol and around the Capitol was going on, so was Antifa rioting in Portland. That continues. And Antifa's ascendance continues generally. Turns out it's not just an idea of President Biden. It's a little bit more than that. Andy Ngo offered this review.
Yeah, my response to the brazen attack at the Capitol Hill siege last week is the same response that I had throughout 2020, when rioters in my home city of Portland and in nearby in Seattle actually tried to break into federal property. In the case of Portland, it was thousands of people for weeks and weeks trying to burn down the federal courthouse in downtown. And when the Trump administration sent in federal law enforcement to help protect that facility, they were called secret police, Gestapo, Nazis, and occupying force by people from all the way from local city council all the way to the governor. So to see now these same people who were at best silent last year and at worst encouraging of riots in the name of BLM and anti-fascism, now condemning the riots that happened in the Capitol, I have disbelief, but I can't say I'm surprised. It's what we have witnessed is the mainstream left in America becoming very, very comfortable with political violence. We shouldn't be surprised that other people of different political views are now of the belief that we resolve our disagreements through violence, apparently.
And Andy Knell, remember, was a victim of violence at the hands of Antifa. They almost killed him. Just going back into last year, since Andy Knell brought us back there, remember this from Kamala Harris' tweet on June 1st of 2020? If you're able to, chip in now to the Minnesota Freedom Fund to help post bail for those protesting on the ground in Minnesota.
And they burnt Minneapolis down to the ground.
Yeah, you don't get arrested for...
They set apartments on fire that people weren't still inside of them, Dan. Remember that?
Yeah, you don't get arrested for...
Sorry.
You don't get arrested for protesting. You get arrested for breaking the law. But I suppose we should look for the 1619 Project to launch a 1621 Project to expunge all the statements made by Democrat socialists during 2020's Summer of Love, as Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin termed it. And by the way, just to reiterate, this is not whataboutism, because there's no excusing what happened at the Capitol on January 6th. This is called consistency with respect to peaceful protest as distinguished from violence. And that's the consistency that's been applied on this show throughout and will continue to be. And that's the consistency that's been applied by most conservatives throughout and will continue to be. And so I suppose it makes these statements from the likes of Kamala Harris, not to mention the ongoing purge, that much more difficult to countenance, doesn't it? For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Selena Zito, Washington Examiner, New York Post, author of the bestseller, The Great Revolt. Selena, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Always a pleasure. And since you wrote this book, The Great Revolt, about Trump's election in 2016, one is wondering these days whether that great revolt in 2016 has been permanently put down by the established order.
So I don't think that in talking with Trump supporters and the aftermath of what happened Wednesday, I don't believe I see great evidence of people still holding the same sentiments about big corporation, big tech, big government, and how they are culturally disconnected from their needs and their lives and their communities. That does not mean that they are not just incredibly repulsed by what happened last Wednesday, and also very disappointed in the president, not just in what happened on Wednesday, but also after a couple of weeks continuing to say that the election was stolen. A lot of Trump supporters have told me, look, I'm sure there was incompetency and there was corruption, but there's never been enough evidence to show that it was enough to turn over any of the states that they were that he was unsatisfied with. And I've written about this since the election, where they've, you know, understood that Biden won. They've understood that Trump lost. But there was this sense of aspiration and hope that he'd do sort of a Grover Cleveland moment, where he would come back and run again in 4 years. And or someone would take up the mantle. Now, after what happened on Wednesday, they just feel so dislodged from hope, because not only did some Trump supporters do something horrid, the reaction has been swift and merciless in boxing people in that ever supported him.
Well, yesterday I spoke to the one Trump supporter in my neighborhood who actually even had a sticker on his car, and he took the sticker off his car, was so upset. He said, I am so, after what happened, I'm not part of this anymore. I'm done. And he hated what Trump did to Vice President Mike Pence. He thought it was absolutely despicable what he did to him. And because what Pence did was he followed the Constitution. He didn't do anything wrong. He wasn't betraying Trump, but he just went along with the letter of the law.
And that is also something very consistent that I have heard from Trump supporters. Most of them have great respect for Mike Pence, have thought that he has been a loyal and calming voice during this administration, and were just absolutely repulsed by the president's tweet and the president's egging people on during that speech before, and they're just heartsick. The worst thing that people thought Trump supporters were and Trump was, meaning their critics, all played out in a half an hour and ruined every good, you know, tainted his legacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although, you know, part of this is if you lie prone, they're not accepting surrender. They're going to roll over you. This is a group that is not taking prisoners. And so if you roll over and allow them to characterize you as just somebody else who, if you had been in D.C., you would have taken a selfie at Nancy Pelosi's desk, too, without pushing back to that ridiculousness, that guilt by association, that painting with a broad brush, then that's exactly what they will do. They're not afraid to say things that are untrue. They're not afraid to engage in character assassination. They're not afraid to, as Bill McGurn argued in the Wall Street Journal, build on Hillary Clinton's half the Trump supporters are deplorables to now all the Trump supporters are deplorables, and they deserve whatever they get in terms of professional, personal, familial repercussions. And by the way, this, of course, is with big tech in tow. And, you know, I saw this tweet from Gateway Pundit, and again, forgetting the source for a second, look at the Standard. He tweeted, they stole an election, now they want silence, now they want to silence anyone who questions the fraud. That was tagged by Twitter, of course, this claim of election fraud is disputed, tweet cannot be replied to, retweeted or liked due to risk of violence. Due to a risk of violence. So here's where we're at. How people interpret content is the basis to censor content. And with social media platforms, frankly, being at least as, if not more powerful than the government culturally, that is a real change in American culture if we're going to abide that, in addition to all of the other sort of cancel culture purge manifestations. So you can point to something and say that was bad, but that's not good enough for those on the left who are looking to score political points. And as Dan Henninger told me yesterday, looking to eliminate conservatives from politics, basically.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. The problem with what happened on Wednesday, and obviously there's multiple problems, people die. Our whole of governing and laws was breached. Having said that, the reaction has been by not just the left, not just by Democrats, but also the cultural curators in the country, the people who control how we buy, how we are entertained, how we consume news, has been something to shudder at and something for people to be deeply concerned about. And all they have done is make things worse, no different than President-elect Biden's reaction of the day of, which was just to, again, he made his speech make things worse. He had a moment to draw people together, and instead, he made it worse, and our cultural curators have done the exact same thing. I'm talking about big tech, big corporations, and so what that does is squeeze people, it alienates people, it isolates people, and we have seen the sort of repercussions of being squeezed and being isolated during a pandemic. You put that, you add that, you know, with pressure from culture and pressure from governing, and you're creating a really big problem.
Well, big tech says, oh, it's not censorship. This is about safety, and we have to protect the people. But people that were at the rally that didn't even get arrested, we had a realtor here, Libby Andrews. She was fired for being at the rally. She wasn't arrested. She never stormed the Capitol. But that's how this has become like a communist state that we're living in, a communist country.
Well, I, you know, before this even happened, cancel culture had become part of American culture. And, people that supported Trump, we talked about the shy Trump voters. Well, there's a reason why they were shy, because of the potential backlash from either your job or your friends or your neighbors. If you put a Trump sign up or you told people how you felt, this is just making people go more underground. And I just don't think it is a level-headed approach to dealing with issues. And here's my biggest concern. Nobody is motivated to change. Nobody has any motivation to stop the divide, because corporations make money off of it. Politicians gain supporters from it. And so we are stuck in we're at the beginning of the problem. We're not at the end of the problem, because nobody's motivated to bring people together.
And among the corporations you reference, media specifically, Matt Taibbi writing at his site at Substack, "We need a new media system. If you sell culture war all day, don't be surprised by the real world consequences." He writes, "News companies now clean world events like whalers, using every part of the animal, funneling different facts to different consumers based upon calculations about what will bring back the biggest engagement kick." And so this is a culmination of what he's previously described. He actually called it the apotheosis of what he's previously described as the hate ink era. This is media companies that traffic in hate for profit.
Yeah, and I this is a big theme throughout the book that I wrote with Brad Todd, in that these cultural curators, corporations, big tech, news organizations, government, bureaucracies, don't have people like you and me working in them. They don't have people that went to a state school or a community college, who grew up and was sitting in a pew every Sunday, or, you know, own a gun, know how to use a gun, and actually know what the word the letters AR mean. And so when you have people that all think alike, don't understand the people that consume their products or consume their news or consume their entertainment, then you make bad decisions in terms of how you conduct your business. And the problems within these big corporations are from within. There's pressure from within. We saw it yesterday with Hallmark. I mean, Hallmark is like the most, you know, on American brand there is, and yesterday they decided to get involved in politics. And you know, they're going to lose customers, but they believe it's worth the risk.
Selena Zito, Washington Examiner reporter, New York Post columnist, CNN contributor of the book, The Great Revolt, Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics. Selena, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, and she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So there's a lot of ink being spilled about Madigan's future right now. A question about whether or not he'll retain his speakership. He has short of the 60 votes he needs to be reelected Speaker of the House, but he also is the leader in the clubhouse in terms of plurality, getting 51 votes in an internal vote that was taken among the House Democrat caucus. He got 51. The next closest competitor, Ann Williams, with 18. So we'll see if there's some sort of compromise candidate or there's a default to Madigan. The question is, replacing Madigan with an Ann Williams or somebody else, one of the fungible members of the House Democrat Caucus. Does that matter any more than it mattered to replace John Cullerton with Don Harmon on the Senate side?
No big difference there.
We'll start there with Ted Dabrowski, who is the president of WirePoints, Inc., wirepoints.org. That's a site that you want to check out for great analytical content on all things Illinois finance and really politics and policy related, the intersection of the two. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy.
So my question, Madigan for candidate to be named later, any different than replacing Cullerton with Harmon?
You know, on the one hand, of course, Madigan's been there for so long that, you know, he runs the machine so well. It's so well oiled, and that's why they've been so successful holding power the way they have. So getting rid of Madigan, you know, will matter. But, I think what we've tried to point out is that the machine he's built is so powerful that whoever takes over, could be worse because they get to take over the machine he's built and do even more extreme things. Madigan is a centrist compared to a lot of the people that might take over. So, you could see things get worse because they'll just get to drive, step into the machine, take over the wheel, and make things worse.
Well, that's it, Matt. That's sort of where I'm intimating, at least in part. I mean, I take the point you're making and others have made to heart. But what you'll do is, yes, you'll have a less powerful Speaker of the House and a more powerful constituency for that Speaker of the House, starting with the public sector union. So all you're doing is ultimately is transferring power away from the Speaker's chair to the public sector unions. And I don't know if anybody's taken a look at how the public sector unions in Illinois behave recently, but they are, number one, not just sort of left of Madigan ideologically, but they get their bread buttered by maintaining the status quo. And we've seen how it's played out with the Chicago teachers, and we've seen how it's played out previously with the service employees as well as AFSCME. I mean, if you think that will change the trajectory of Illinois, that redistribution of power towards the public sector unions, then you don't understand anything about Illinois.
Well, that's right. And, you know, you don't even have to wait until the next General Assembly. Just look at what's happening now. You know, I look at this like the shiny object. We're all looking at what's happening with Madigan. But it's amazing what's being passed right now, the laws that are being passed, or I should say the bills that are being passed, and we'll go to Pritzker. In this time period, they've given Chicago Teachers Union more bargaining power under new law. So, you know, here's CTU that struck three times in a row in the last decade, won't go back to school, and yet lawmakers just gave them more bargaining power. And it might, if it has immediate effect, they won't even go back to school. So that's number one. Number two, they just gave firefighters, if you know anything about Chicago pensions, they're broke. And if you know anything about the firefighters' pension fund, it's among the most broke in the country. And yet these lawmakers just increased COLAs to the firefighters. And number three, you know, they pushed more money into education for social justice. So, yeah, like what you just said, Dan, is precisely right. It's just that it doesn't have. We don't even have to wait for Madigan to be changed. It's happening as we speak because it's a free for all right now under the new environment we're in.
Well, Ted, what's the chances that Governor Pritzker won't sign this bill when it comes to, you know, the CTU having more power, determining class size, length of day, and the school year length?
Well, you know, the thing is, there's no way that Pritzker doesn't sign this. This is right in his alley. CTU's been able to strike anyway, regardless of whether they've had these powers or not, but this just gives them even more power because now they can say, hey, I don't want to come in for COVID because of COVID into classes, and that's one of the big reasons they're pushing for this. They don't want to come back to school. It's crazy, but that's the power that the legislature's just given the CTU.
Well, they had two strikes yesterday, one outside Dawes Elementary, and are they going to get fired? I mean, Janice Jackson said that if they don't show up for work again today, then they're not going to get paid. That's different than getting fired.
Yeah, it's hard to see how she would go through with that. I like the fact that she's actually threatened that because that's how it should be. We've talked a lot about COVID and kids needing to be in school. But if they were fired, that would be a huge move. But it's not going to happen, I don't think. I don't think there's enough political will there to make that happen.
House, we've talked about some of the other legislation pending, particularly with respect to changing the way policing works in Illinois. But also this, House Bill 2685, Senate floor amendment, The bill maintains the state's contracting goals for minorities, women, and persons with disabilities for construction contracts at 20%. However, it would amend that act to require the state to award state contracts, including construction contracts, but not limited to descendants of African slavery proportionate to the state's population. So this is a reparations play. The proposal also creates the Commission on Equity and Inclusion and gives the Commission power to approve procurements, propose procurement rules, recommend contract cancellations, participate in the approval of procurement officers. Also this, forbids employers from using arrests that didn't lead to convictions in hiring, firing, and promotion, creates additional housing rights for those with criminal records, requires state agencies to publish race and gender wage reports, creates an African Descent Citizens Reparations Commission. Again, all the focus on, you know, who is going to be the titular head of the Democrat Socialist Party, who's going to command the Speaker's gavel. Meanwhile, below the surface, you have all these parallel tracks that have been laid down to make communities less safe through the policing changes, to make Illinois less financially solvent through the sops to the public sector unions, and to further make business, make Illinois hostile to business through all of these identitarian mandates on business, not just construction either.
Well, I think this is kind of hitting at the heart of what's happening in Chicago and in the state largely, you know, especially through these changes, is that, you know, we're no longer going to look at competence or merit as the reason for somebody to have a contract or somebody to gain employment or for how we do anything. We seem to be in every document you see and a lot of the laws that you're seeing, it's something about through the lens of equity or through the lens of systemic racism. And so it's going to make it very difficult to judge anything anymore because it's no longer based on, like I said, merit or competence. And it's just giving more and more power to different groups. And I think it's just going to make a mess of Illinois. And it's going to be really hard to unwind because it's becoming so embedded in all these different contracts, clauses. And it's going to be difficult for us to compete as a state against other states that are competing on job creation, investment. It's going to be tough.
Support bailouts, really, for state and local governments. This is something that's on the wish list of both Mayor Lightfoot and Governor Pritzker. The happy day when Joe Biden won the presidential election. So that means they're going to get, aid, relief is how they characterize it from the federal government, they think. And then people suggest, you know, the way people understand these things, oh, bailout. So the federal government's going to come and bail them out. Is there any amount of money that's realistic that could come from the federal government to Chicago and Illinois that would make a material difference in the state of the city and state's financial affairs?
No, there's not. But Dan, that's not really the right question. The question is it enough just to perpetuate what they're doing for another year, two years, or 3 years? And that's the game, right? It's never about fixing the problem. It's only about keeping things going and keeping your power, at least while you're in. If you look at some of the – it's interesting. If you look at the new law that where the CTU would get more bargaining power, Lori Lightfoot says she supports it as long as it starts, guess what, after her term.
2024.
Right? So it's beautiful,
after
right?
After that contract, yeah.
Yeah, so this is the way it's working. I think what's fascinating about this whole thing going on right now is – you know, we've been suffering under COVID, and you've heard every single reason why we should have lockdowns or schools should be closed and all that. So here the legislature comes in. There's been 10 months of executive order by Pritzker, and there's not been one word or any effort to strip him of those executive order privileges and to take over by the legislature what's happening in the state, nor has there been anything to talk about creating more jobs, you know, getting businesses back open, getting schools back open, nothing about that. And that's what everybody's suffering under. So they've skipped all that, and they've gone over to the extreme stuff that they're talking about. And, meanwhile, everybody's left hanging. But like you say, it's all because I think they're just saying, hey, we're going to get several billion from the federal government. Let's just do what we can while we can, and there's nothing to stop us now.
And same with the vaccines. I mean, Pritzker said, oh, well, we'll have mass vaccinations, you know, where people will line up to go out of their Soldier Field or McCormick Place. only after Biden is president. And it's like, why don't we do it now? Why don't we do what they're doing in Florida right now? Because we have some vaccines that are sitting on shelves. Well, not in shelves, but in refrigerators or freezers.
Well, I think, you know, it just comes back to nothing makes sense in Illinois right now. There's no laws that make sense. No actions make sense. Everything is politically motivated or has nothing to do, again, with competence. It has all to do with identity politics. And so, therefore, we can't figure out what should happen. And I think, you know, Illinois is, I think, a microcosm of what's happening at the national level. We're just way ahead of it. And, you know, money doesn't matter at the federal level anymore. You got the modern monetary theory versus you know, the good old days of fiscal conservatism. So,
but there's no opposition, too. I mean, there's no organized opposition, and so they just have the run of the place. I mean, even relative to New York and California, I would suggest there's less organized opposition here. At least in California, you have a recall petition afoot with 1 million signatures. In New York, you have Andrew Cuomo feeling the political pressure to do basically a 180 during his State of the State address yesterday and opening the economy. Here, the closest thing you have is Rick Bayless penning a letter to the mayor and city council and by extension the governor asking for scraps. I mean, his letter is so instructive of the serf mentality in the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago. Just let us open 20 to 25%. We promise we'll be safe. Restaurants. There is no sort of overarching principled demand being made of anybody in a real position of authority. And, you know, the handful of Republicans milling about to no particular consequence are as irrelevant as most of the members of the Chicago City Council.
Well, you're absolutely right. And there's been, you know, I talked about this recently. There is no plan. Obviously, the Democrats don't have a plan. Or their plan is just to increase everything they're doing by you know, several fold. But I think on the opposition side, nobody's put together a plan that says, you know, some principled objectives. Here's what we want. And so nobody's got anything to look at as an alternative. So there's no opposition, as you say. And that's the sad part. You know, people need to start putting together leadership of the Republican Party and others need to start putting a plan together that says, here's what we stand for. Here's what we want to do. And if you give us a chance, here's what we will do. But
in lieu of a big plan, what do you have? You have a bunch of little plans, and the little plans are individual families' plans to get out of Illinois, which continues unabated. Illinois continuing to lead the nation in out-migration.
Well, that's precisely right, and that's precisely why people just leave. That's the only alternative. There's no recall, so you just leave, and people shrug their shoulders every day. You know, I don't know if people do it. Okay, a lot of people do purposely leave. They're tired of the combination of there's not enough good jobs, the governments are too corrupt, and it's just too expensive to live here. That's why they leave. But others just say, hey, look at the opportunities right over the border in Indiana or Wisconsin or Florida or Texas. And I talked about, you know, the blacks are leaving because they see places like Atlanta and Houston as friendly to their entrepreneurship and ability to do more. So, you know, that's really the political vote in Illinois is just to leave. And that's the sad part.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, Inc. That's at wirepoints.com. Get all of their content on a daily basis, breaking out the economic picture, the policy implications of everything happening in Chicago and Illinois. It's good reading. Ted, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and then they came for talk radio. There is no limiting principle, and there is no corporate entity that won't feel the pressure. And so how will some react? Before we even get to that, it's as a sort of foundation to the conversation. Do you find it astounding that individuals like German Chancellor Angela Merkel are more strident defenders of our First Amendment rights and our culture of free expression than so many American CEOs and cultural mavens. Merkel slamming Twitter's decision to ban Trump as problematic, a violation of a quote-unquote fundamental right. Wow.
Somebody's sticking up for us across the pond.
Well, my former employer, Cumulus Media.
And mine, too.
Yeah.
Don't forget.
WLS
we
is Cumulus owned.
We both served time there, yes.
Yeah. A memo went out from Cumulus Media's executive vice president of content, Brian Phillips. We need to help induce national calm now. The company, quote, will not tolerate any suggestion that the election has not ended. The election has been resolved. There are no alternate acceptable paths, quote unquote. If you transgress this policy, you can expect to separate from the company immediately.
Yeah, please inform your staff that we have zero tolerance, all in capitals, for any suggestion otherwise.
So that in the employ of Cumulus includes one Rush Limbaugh, one Mark Levin, important voices on talk radio. And, you know, it's one of those things where you say, oh, well, all they're saying is, well, you can't say that the election isn't over because the election is over. Yeah, I agree. The election's over. But does that policy extend or not extend to continuing conversations, particularly as perhaps more evidence becomes available about those statistical anomalies that occurred in the 2020 election as information becomes available based on perhaps Republican state legislatures doing in 2021 and going forward what they didn't do in 2020, which is reestablish their legislative power to write the rules that govern state elections and not allow that power to be usurped by the judicial branch or administrative agencies that had happened in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Georgia, for that matter.
What about the people who voted twice? You can't. Well, can you report on that? I mean, that's fraudulent voters. Is that part of this? 312-642-5600 Turnkey Depro answer line.
Yeah. It's interesting because I've never, and this includes at Cumulus, but much more so at Salem here, never been instructed as to what I can or can't say. Never.
Never. No.
Nor should you be, because if you don't have a sense of what is appropriate to drive a substantive conversation, then you probably shouldn't be a talk show host in the first place. Very much like we talk about, you know, the government having faith in its citizens, your employer having faith in employees. Well, that extends to this going concern.
He went on to say there will be no dog whistle talk about stolen elections, civil wars, or any other language that infers violent public disobedience is warranted ever. 312-642-5600.
By contrast, our point man for all the on-air talent, Phil Boyce, penned a missive where he defended talk radio because he knows at least what talk radio is at Salem, what we do here and our colleagues like Prager and Gallagher and Elder and so many more, what they do, which is to encourage dissent, actually. We relish the caller who disagrees with us so we can put the argument side by side. As Boyce writes in his piece, Talkers Magazine, nobody I know in talk radio incites violence. The whole existence of talk radio relies on the free and fair exchange of words and ideas. Right. To say you have to fight for what you believe in does not mean physical violence. It describes the attitude with which one to take on this culture war. Right. Of course. Exactly. Of course, he's exactly correct. That's the approach. But if talk radio is in the crosshairs and maybe, you know, willingly by some inside talk radio at places like Cumulus, then you think you're going to have a platform to speak your mind? You think you're going to have platforms that reflect your viewpoints, that put in the fight intellectually, as I was just describing, without incident? I don't think so. This is the time we're in. And as we've talked about now for the last several days since what happened on January 6th, the left sees no downside to this purge, and so they are speeding in every direction to use the power that they have built over many generations to impose their will and silence their intellectual and political opponents. What happens on a college campus doesn't stay on a college campus. So the safe spaces and the speech with which I disagree is violence, redefinitions that have gone on over the last generation in particular, that were funny to some until now when they're not so funny, when people are getting fired and their kids are getting kicked out of school or prevented from attending the schools they want, or they're being sort of ostracized from civil society and they're losing friends and they can't figure it out.
You know,
these are the cancers that we allow to metastasize by not putting in the fight in this culture war.
You know, I was just thinking about it. Did they give Rush Limbaugh the memo about this?
That Lee and Hammond, you're on Chicago. I'm sorry.
Oh, I just said, do you think that they talked to Rush Limbaugh about this?
Hello?
Because he's on that station and they don't need, you know, they're going to tell him not to use the words stolen election or possibly fraudulent votes, and they're going to kick him off the air. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
The First Amendment. I think Cumulus ought to, go ahead and pull the licenses of these Cumulus stations if they're going to not honor the First Amendment. I think people ought to contact their congressman and have them put pressure on the FCC to do their job. And, they're not even in power yet. And you can imagine what's coming in the next 6 months or a year. You know, it's just gotten that crazy.
Thanks for the call, Lee. Bob in Michigan.
Yes, I was just telling your screener that yesterday I had listened to three of the hosts on Somulus, and they have heard of the memo, but none of the three have received it so far.
Okay. I mean, I don't know if I mean, maybe they didn't have a chance to look at it. I have no idea. But, you know, usually if you have a missive from your boss, like we get missives from our boss, it's emailed to you. So it's not like they're sitting by their mailbox waiting for it. If National Review and other outlets have a copy of what that Cumulus executive wrote, then somebody had to be on the distribution list. You know what I mean? Will in South Carolina.
Hey, I was just calling about the hey. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Will. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're on. Go ahead. Yeah,
hey,
go ahead.
I just wanted to get y'all's opinions on what's, you know, been going on in the whole capital issue and what's about the, you know, stimulus checks and things like that.
Okay, thanks for the call, Will. In part, we're talking about with respect to what happened on January 6th and the fallout from it. That's what we're talking about. You know, all that you see corporate America moving in a synchronized way to deplatform Trump, these memos that are circulating internally in corporations. Many corporations, you don't even need the memo, right? Because this has been their culture for some time. the announcements of no more contributions to Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, right? The calls by some to have Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley disbarred. Their colleagues calling on them to resign their offices. Why? Because they did the same thing that Democrats did in the last three elections, won by a Republican, and lodged an objection that they're legally allowed to do under a law that's been on the books for 230 years. That's where things are at. Cheryl at Midway.
Hi, Dan and Amy. On Friday, I heard Tucker Carlson talking about CNN trying to get Fox News off the air, that they went to all the cable companies, so that they wouldn't carry them. How come a bigger issue hasn't been made of that?
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, sure. I mean, this is what the left does, is boycott. And we'll talk to Mark Bauerlein at the bottom of the hour about this. This is exactly what the left does in institutions controlled by the left. They're in the business of boycotting. Go back to that observation from Wall Street Journal's Dan Henninger that we've talked about previously in the show. The opportunity the left sees here is to eliminate conservatives from politics and, by extension, power. To eliminate. Not to take advantage of this electoral victory to move their agenda, so on and so forth. These are not the customary times. This is well beyond spoils of war politics. This is, the war is over, you're defeated, we're not going to open prisoner camps, we're not going to open re-education centers. Eliminate. Rewrite out of history, past and present. Rich in Antioch.
Hi, good morning. It really concerns me. What's going to happen to stations like yours? I mean, the pressure to pull advertisers, the government. One caller recently stated that we can talk to our Congress people. Well, listen, I got Lauren Underwood and Dick Durbin representing me. It's like they're going to do anything. So, I mean, just really concerning. I got the station up the dial that I can't stand, and where the truth doesn't matter, facts don't matter. It's so frustrating, Dan and Amy, that where do you turn anymore? I can put a bumper sticker on my car or fly my flag, but what the hell else? I mean, it's so frustrating.
Well,
that's
Rich,
all.
You're safe here. I think we're going to be fine.
Well, here's the larger point I reference this semi-regularly because it merits it. Put in the fight for what you think is right, even if you think you're on the losing side, you may turn out to be wrong. The life and times of Whitaker Chambers. If you are despondent, you haven't been through anything yet. Neither have I. Read Witness. Read about Whitaker Chambers' life. That should buoy your spirits and maybe your resolve a bit. And then, as we talked about here, focus in areas where you have the most control or influence. Right. Start from your family out to national politics. Don't think you're going to fix Washington, D.C. from suburban Chicago. Focus on where you can make an impact in suburban Chicago, wherever you live now, wherever you're going to live. Through household, community civic organizations, maybe local units of government. We talked to a guy from Grays Lake yesterday is like, I'm tired of bitching about my local school. I'm running for school board.
Yep.
There you
Kevin,
go.
Kevin, vote for him.
I think it was Ken.
Or Ken. Yeah, we never got his last name, though.
Roy in Hickory Hills.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Good show. Just a thought for the 74 million of us who voted for Trump to possibly start boycotting some of these firms that are taking care of the free speech that we should all be having, like Simon and Schuster. Start there with the senator who can't publish a book. And then once some of the networks go up that allow us our platform to change everybody from Twitter over to the new platform. And then possibly you know, just continue doing those things and going after the firms that aren't allowing the free speech.
Yeah, well, Twitter stock tumbled yesterday. I mean, it fell as much as 12%. Ended up a little higher. But still, I mean, people were upset about it. And it affected their, you know, their bottom line. So I'm fine with that.
But I agree. You should tell your friends that don't listen to WLS. Come over to AM560.
Always, Dan.
That's a good idea, Roy.
Yeah.
Byron and Lombard, here at Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey. I've been listening to you guys all summer. Great show. You guys are my inspiration each morning when I wake up.
Thank you.
I correlate this to the communist blacklisting of the 40s and 50s and what it took to overcome that. Eventually, a leftist sued and started the process to break the blacklisting. I don't know if that's how this is going to happen or not, but, you know, that's similar to it. My hope for us is the midterm elections. There's a lot of people out there that are very, very disappointed with what's going on. And our only hope is the midterm elections right now. All right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, thanks. You guys take care.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Byron. Right, yeah, trying to channel the disappointment and the frustration, the exasperation to something productive after, you know, an understandable mourning period or you know, period away from the political arena, if you want. The problem is right now the political arena or those in it are coming for those who supported President Trump in every way, in shape, and form. But yes, the midterms, something to look forward to. Larry and Carol Stream.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I'm just wondering, you know, the First Amendment says the government can't control speech. But is there something that says a company can't control what their people say or what they do? I'm all in favor of telling the company to go pound sand, but I don't know if I have a legal basis to say that they can't control my speech as a company member.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Larry. Obviously a private enterprise has much more authority to regulate your speech and your conduct than does the government. I don't want to get too deep into an HR discussion now. There are limitations. There's things that could trigger court action or a legitimate grievance to be adjudicated by a court. But this is the point I was making yesterday, I think. You know, for conservatives who think that we are to bow at the altar of capitalism, and, you know, there's no bigger Milton Friedman fan than me, but the idea that we're free to choose and that's the end of the discussion, well, that's not the end of the discussion. In fact, it's not even the beginning of the discussion, because we've freely chosen Netflix, Amazon, Twitter, Facebook. We freely chosen those companies. They haven't been imposed on us by government. We freely chose them. And now where do we find ourselves? Where you have those big tech oligarchs, not to mention the Fortune 1000 companies generally, that are woke and they're not going broke. You are. And they're doing things that the government can't legally do and perhaps wouldn't even if they could, because of political consequences. So, part of it may be changing the discussion back to the starting point, which is one of good versus evil, rather than the idea of maximum autonomy as the ultimate good and the salvation of a free society. As we're finding out, it isn't, is it? There's only one person in the business of salvation to look to. It's not a CEO.
No.
Russ in Crystal Lake.
Man upstairs.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about
Munchkin
line.
More
the Munchkin line. Sorry, Russ.
The Munchkin line's infiltrating more than line one. It's now on line three, too.
I don't know which will happen first. We'll be taken off the air. We'll get phones that work. Tony and Steger.
Hey, guys. Hey. It seems like I call in a lot, but this station is the only station I can listen to.
We're
because
here.
The other ones, I can't stomach them. And another thing, the stimulus checks, they're going to find out if you're a Republican, and they won't give it to you until you sign a piece of paper saying that you denounce Trump and everyone else.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And a conversation with journalist Andy Ngo, who's been covering Antifa since those thugs almost killed him in Portland. He had some interesting observations about the coverage of all the violence and civil unrest that occurred last summer into the fall and continues, an important observation, and continues as compared to the reactions and the coverage of what transpired on January 6th.
I mean, my takeaway from this whole thing is just the disparate treatment when it comes to right-wing versus left-wing political violence. The massive coverage on what happened at Capitol Hill is not just, I mean, what happened is significant, but it's being overblown to people comparing it to 9/11, where thousands of people were actually killed, comparing it to a Pearl Harbor. And I find those comparisons quite disrespectful and not accurate of the events of the day. And then on the flip side, when it comes to covering actual insurgency attempts that are organized and funded and go on for months and months in major American cities, there's no coverage. So then the perception is that there's no threat coming from Antifa extremism.
Right. There's no threat coming from Antifa extremism, except if you are paying attention and to get accurate, consistent coverage of what's happening with that movement, you really don't have to go to Andy Ngo. Here's what's happening. Antifa is ascendant in his view.
Well, we're not even 2 weeks into 2021, and there's already been multiple Antifa-led riots in major American cities. And on top of that, since the Twitter banning of the U.S. president, there have been other protests by Antifa held in the streets that have become violent. 2 days ago, there was one in San Diego, and they were recorded on camera with signs saying, for example, that Ashley Babbitt deserved to die. She was one of the protesters who was killed at the Capitol. They were holding their propaganda flags and symbols, and they assaulted some Trump supporters on the beach. And then yesterday in Manhattan, there was a militia-style parade by Antifa. They were marching in the streets of Manhattan holding shields and in their black shirt uniforms and their riot gear and talking about how these streets are theirs. So they are ascendant and that they feel empowered, and that not only do they have now a soft ally in the incoming administration, they also have quite explicit allies in big tech.
Soft ally in the incoming administration and explicit allies in big tech. Antifa does. Not just an idea. How is that so? Well, for perhaps an explanation to the dynamic that Andy Ngo describes comes to us from Mark Bauerlein. He is an English professor at Emory University. He is also the author of the book, and I want to get this title right because it's, you know, it's one of those titles that you can't remember, but you remember it's funny.
It's a long one. Take a deep breath.
I want to make sure I get the book right. It's The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Professor Bauerlein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
So what Andy Ngo is describing about the disparate coverage, the attention paid, even the acknowledgement, the existence of when it comes to leftist violence, not just what we saw over the summer, but even in real time as we're having a discussion about where the lines are properly drawn with respect to protest versus criminal conduct. Do you have an explanation as to why that may be, why those who preach nonviolence from the left when it comes to rioting inside the Capitol are not willing to do so when it comes to rioting on the streets of Portland or San Diego or Manhattan?
Well, liberals in power for, you know, 80 years have known that there is a violent left in America. It goes back 100 years with some of the labor movements, the socialists, and going through the 60s, the SDS, and now Antifa. They know that there is a violent left, but liberals have always granted left-wing protests, left-wing militants with a certain degree of legitimacy. They don't like the violence, but they're willing to acknowledge, yes, you have a legitimate grievance. It could be racial grievance, sexual grievance, whatever. And so they have formed ways of kind of appeasing, containing the left. Now, right-wing violence, which is a much, much smaller thing, they then have a vested interest in exaggerating the reality of right-wing violence. They can put themselves in the kind of reasonable middle, trying to moderate between the extremes in American life. So they have to exaggerate what happened at the Capitol. We know it was bad, but they have to build it up into something much worse than all of the looting, the fires, the rioting that took place last summer in order to maintain their position as the reasonable, responsible elite who deserves to run these institutions. And, you know, liberal leaders have an investment in maintaining order and stability. The left loves disorder and instability. That's how you bring about revolution. When you turn the society upside down, when you make people feel uneasy, dissatisfied, that's when you can introduce radical changes. This is really the positioning that is going on with the Antifa. It's a form of intimidation. It's telling leaders in tech, in corporations, in politics, you better give us some of the things we want. And of course, no matter what Joe Biden gives them, they will always maintain the adversarial attitude because that's how they get more.
And it's hypocritical because, I mean, big tech hasn't silenced Antifa or BLM, but yet they silenced President Trump on every platform imaginable.
That's right. And they're going to keep doing it when they apply the double standards. We all know how inconsistent it all is. They shrug. This is the way we are operating. I mean, right now, the media, most journalists now, younger journalists, the millennial journalists, the dumbest generation. I actually have a book coming out in a few months called Dangerous Utopians, The Dumbest Generation Grows Up. They're 30 years old now, and they don't believe really in the First Amendment. They succumb to ideas of let's create the society we all want to live in. This ends up being a process of manufacturing a reality. Younger journalists, the media, are not in pursuit of the truth. They are trying to fabricate a vision that will bring about, again, the wonderful utopian world that we're all supposed to live in, where there's no discrimination and everyone's equal and nobody is deprived and everybody is happy. The media are an instrumental part of this utopian process. And so this is the way we have to approach journalism today. It's not about truth. It's all tactics. It's strategies.
And just to, you know, some concrete examples to illustrate what you're saying. This is why Harvard professor Lawrence Tribe signs on to a petition to seek the disbarment of Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley. You know, he has to be seen as indulging the activist left, lest he lose his sinecure at Harvard, he lose his social status associated with being a man of the left in, you know,
that's
the,
right.
The hallowed halls of academia. And so I think this is, it's difficult for people to, until they think this through the way you have, to understand why those people who decry violence on the one hand refuse to take on Jacobins on the left. And this
right.
is the this is the explanation for it, that they can't do that and maintain what they have. And their charge is, you know, to keep the wheel spinning, to keep the money coming into these institutions, to maintain everybody's status. So give them what they want, because they can just create havoc for us. You know, as you said, appease them. But you have to create a real enemy to fight. And so then they go all in
yeah.
with scapegoating the right.
This is where the whole rhetorical game of victimization and injustice comes into play. Lawrence Tribe is a straight white male. He's at the top of an institution that has been accused of being guilty of systemic racism for decades. That means that he has to do penance. He has to demonstrate. He knows he's kind of guilty, but he wants to be innocent, and so he is going to sign on. Joe Biden is actually the perfect president for the activist left, because he's a guilty old white man who must do permanent penitence. He is a much better president for them to have than Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris has an identity that looks at the activist left on those grounds and saying, I don't know you nothing. Joe Biden is guilty. He has to prove his innocent motives today, every single week. That's why you have so many college presidents who are old white males. Instead of forcing them to step down and put a person of color in there, the whole game of guilt would go away.
And then so Evergreen State University, you have the old white male president of Evergreen State who sides with the mob against liberal Professor Brett Weinstein, who wouldn't go along with the, you know, all white people off campus for a day, activism of the left on that campus. But the university president throws Weinstein under the bus because he can't take on those Jacobins. And so so you see this repeating itself. And this comes from a place, as AOC, since you mentioned her, is you know, the great avatar of this. I don't have to be technically correct because I'm morally correct. All of this cancellation comes from this basis that my position is the morally superior position, so it doesn't need to countenance dissent, and it doesn't need to countenance dissenters. And anybody who stands in our way or does not fall in line with us gets rolled over because they're moral inferiors.
I wish that Republican senators, politicians, would learn the lesson of this election for Donald Trump. After 4 years of accusations of racist, his segment of the minority vote went up, and it went up significantly. There are many middle-class African-Americans and Hispanics, Latinos, who are tired of hearing the victim narrative. They have moved into the middle class, and a lot of them don't want to hear. And the Republicans are listening too much to the activists in those minority groups and the media figures in those minority groups. They are not representative of as many voters as they think they are. Of course, most voters still go with the Democrats, but the numbers are changing. If you start ignoring this victimology narrative and treat them as Americans. We're all Americans, and this is a land of opportunity. It's not a land of racism.
When college campuses have been the sort of the canary in the coal mine for culture, what's the next iteration of the purge on a college campus, tenure or no tenure? I know most of the dissent has been and dissenters have been eliminated, but what do you see next? I mean, considering you're an English prof at Emory.
What I'll say is the places where the identity politics have been strongest, that is in the humanities, those are dying. Students are leaving those areas of the college campus. They're not majoring in English and history nearly as much as they used to. Those fields are down 25-30%.
in terms of majors in the last 10 years. So students are voting with their feet, and administrators are kind of happy to let those fields wither away. Their big issue is science, research, federal dollars, big investment in business schools, professional schools. So in that sense, the university is becoming more and more of a kind of research. They run hospitals and things like that. So that's one thing we're seeing. And the purge is complete. It's done. Conservatives don't exist. They were 10% 30 years ago. Now they're 2%. So the personnel factor is over. Now I think the issue is going to be, can leftists run these centers? Can liberal leaders run these centers by appeasing leftists while still appearing like viable intellectual enterprises? I don't think they're going to be very successful in doing that. But a lot of these schools, like Williams College, they have a ton of money. The elite can go on doing this for a long, long time.
He is Professor Mark Bauerlein, English professor at Emory University, senior editor of First Things, author of The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Professor Bauerlein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.